Hello, and welcome to the EcoMedics podcast, where we explore how the health of our planet affects the health of the people on it, and how we, as healthcare professionals, have the power to lead the way in curbing the climate crisis and to be pioneers in building sustainable healthcare systems. Thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Ashling, a junior doctor and member of the EcoMedics team, and we have an incredible lineup of guests who will be joining me on each episode to share their experience and expertise about health and the environment. A warm welcome to Shireen Kassam, who has joined me today to discuss the science behind plant-based diets for both human and planetary health. Shireen is a consultant haematologist and senior lecturer at King's College Hospital in London, with a special interest in the treatment of patients with lymphoma, a cancer of the lymphatic system. Her discovery of the power of nutrition in the prevention and treatment of disease has led to her becoming fully immersed in this topic, founding the organisation Plant-Based Health Professionals in 2017 and delivering evidence-based education around plant-based nutrition. Her work has been published by The Times and BBC Food, and she is passionate about promoting both the health and environmental benefits of a fully plant-based diet. Thank you so much for being here today, Shireen. It's a real honour to get to talk to you about your work.
Oh, thanks, Ashling. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So, of course, you're a haematology consultant, but could you share with us where this diversion into plant-based nutrition stemmed from? And is there a link with your day-to-day clinical job?
Yeah, thank you. Interesting question. It takes me back to 2013, really, when I decided to adopt a vegan diet, predominantly because of ethical reasons. I'd been vegetarian since 2001, but it soon became clear to me that consuming animals or any of their products was no longer aligned with my moral and ethical compass. So I became vegan for those reasons. But that then opened up a whole wealth of information that really linked our diet choices with our personal health, and also, you know, more recently becoming interested in the impact of the food system and our diet choice on planetary health. And back in 2013, I was getting most of my education from the US, particularly when it came to the role of plant-based diets in promoting personal health and well-being, and plant-based nutrition as a mode of treatment alongside conventional allopathic medicine to improve the health and quality of life of our patients. And, you know, it took me a good 4 or 5 years to become comfortable about talking about the benefits of a plant-based diet. And then I thought, well, you know, I've learned all of this and I'm still looking around and talking to my colleagues and looking at syllabus at medical schools and universities, and it's not really being taught in the same way that it seems to be being taught outside of the UK, particularly, as I say, in the US. And so I thought, well, I need to bring that education to the UK. And my first step was to create a community interest company called Plant-Based Health Professionals UK, which is dedicated to providing education and advocacy on healthy plant-based diets for all the benefits it brings to our personal health, planetary health, and of course the animals as well. And in doing that, I was able to create and expand a growing network of like-minded health professionals who are also using plant-based diets in their clinical practice to improve health and well-being of their patients, because it's such a crucial part of, you know, how we live and how we how well we thrive on this planet.
That's really interesting. So it was kind of a two-pronged approach that you got involved. It wasn't just for the sort of health benefits. There was that environmental and ethical sort of element to it as well. And obviously, the main topic that we discuss on the EcoMedics podcast is around sustainability. But something that I've really learned through doing this podcast and generally in having an interest in health sustainability is that keeping our patients healthy in the first place and negating the need for medical input is one of the most important things we can do as health professionals to protect the environment. So while we can streamline and improve the services and processes within the health environment, ultimately, by stopping the patients getting to that point, it sort of reduces our need and our impact as a health service. So that it's kind of interesting that both sort of played into you becoming more interested in this topic.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think you really have hit the nail on the head, as it were, in that, if we want a health, sustainable healthcare system, we need to reduce our reliance on healthcare. And that can only be done through promoting good health and preventing chronic illness. And, it was rather shocking for me to realise quite late into my medical career that 80% of the chronic conditions we look after in the NHS could be prevented, if not hugely delayed in their onset. So 40% of cancers could be prevented. 80 to 90% of cardiovascular disease could be prevented by addressing modifiable lifestyle factors, which also include socioeconomic determinants of health as well. And to really not be prioritizing that in our everyday healthcare just seems so wrong to me. And as you asked, how does haematology fit into this wider picture of nutrition, lifestyle? Well, all my patients have additional chronic comorbidities. By no means is lymphoma preventable as such. But when patients come to see me, they inevitably have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, pre-diabetes, diabetes. They may be carrying too much weight. And these conditions really impact the treatments I'm able to offer them. It impacts how they tolerate treatment. And then ultimately, their risks of getting side effects from these treatments that we are prescribing, whether it be short-term or longer-term side effects. Because we know that people living with cancer or living after cancer have an increased risk of chronic conditions like cardiovascular disease and second cancers. And despite, hematology having some of the most curable lymphomas, my patients will live less long than their age-matched counterparts because they die early of these other comorbidities. So I think there's a huge piece of work to be done there within the cancer field, including hematological cancers.
So there's a role even in the treatment of these diseases rather than the prevention, because I think there has been a big drive towards healthy diets to prevent lots of the cardiovascular diseases. And that's something that we are encouraged, particularly in GP, to promote within our consultations. But there is that other element, which I suppose I hadn't really thought about before, with the treatment and how fit you are to be treated, and that your likelihood of recovering from some of these diseases, including cancers, which is really interesting to hear you talk about.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, despite the fact that it is in all our guidelines for chronic conditions about promoting healthy diet and lifestyle, as of today, the NHS only spends about 5% on prevention. The rest is spent on, the management of established chronic disease. So we do need to flip that sort of spending and importance given to prevention around. It should really be the other way around. But yes, within cancer care, I think we have the most evidence for cancer survivorship. So I'm seeing people in secondary care. I don't have the ability right this minute to sort of impact the chronic conditions that they may have accumulated prior to getting to me. But one really, really interesting development is that some of our newer treatments are really sort of targeting the patient's own immune system, so immunotherapy, which really harnesses the patient's ability to activate their immune cells to then control the cancer. And there's been a lot of research looking at the health of the microbiome and how that impacts patients' responses to these newer immunotherapies. And that also includes stem cell transplantation. And basically, to summarize a rather extensive amount of research, the healthier your gut microbiome, the better you're going to respond with less side effects to some of these newer immunotherapies. And, we all know that a healthy microbiome requires the right nutrients, which are essentially the nutrients found in plant foods like fiber and polyphenols and resistant starches. So there is a role during treatment. However, I think most people aren't able to make, large changes during treatment when they're coming to terms with their diagnosis, the life altering treatments they need to go through. And that's a lot to deal with. So most of these sort of healthy lifestyle habits and how to adopt them, I tend to address sort of once treatment's finished. Hopefully my patients have achieved a remission, looking to take back control of their life and live a longer, better quality life. So yeah, I think there's a big role, and I think we need to all be embracing lifestyle medicine, healthy diet and nutrition counselling within all our practices.
And how does plant-based nutrition fit into all of this?
So the evidence is clear. It's been clear for decades that a healthy diet that promotes health and well-being, that reduces our risk of chronic conditions, is one that is predominantly based around whole plant foods or is 100% plant-based. So I don't tell my patients to go vegan. I tell them that a healthy diet is centered around fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, nuts and seeds, with mainly water for thirst. That's very much in line with current guidance, whether it be the Eat Well Guide from the dietary guidelines in the UK, whether it be, you know, our National Food Strategy document or the Eat Lancet Planetary Health Plate. The only foods known to promote health and well-being are those minimally processed plant foods. And the closer you get towards eating a diet that is centered around that, whether it be Mediterranean or the DASH diet, or, you know, the traditional Indian or African diets, which are mainly plant-based, the healthier you'll be. And if you choose to be 100% plant-based, we know from all the dietetic organizations around the world that 100% plant-based or vegan diets are nutritionally adequate and can sustain health and well-being from cradle to grave, essentially all stages of life.
So it is healthy and safe to be fully plant-based? Because that is a question I think that lots of people have, and that tends to be a lot of the pushback. You know, what about all these nutrients that you get from meat and from dairy? How would you get all of those in a plant-based diet? So you're suggesting you don't necessarily need them?
Absolutely. It's well established in the medical literature, endorsed by the British Dietetic Association, that have had position statements out for several years, you know, telling us, telling the UK public that if you choose to eat 100% plant-based diet, if it's appropriately planned, and that phrase applies to any diet pattern. I would suggest that most of us don't have appropriately planned diets in the UK, but if appropriately planned, 100% plant-based diet is healthy for all stages of life. There is no doubt. Now, you know, whether somebody includes small amounts of animal products in their diet or not does come down to personal choice, but we do have the choice as humans, as opportunistic omnivores, to choose not to consume animal products.
So what are the nutrients or vitamins that we need to be thinking more about to make sure we incorporate if we are cutting out or reducing animal-based products?
Yeah, that's a great question. So any diet pattern you choose will have certain nutrients that are found in abundance and certain nutrients that will be less abundant that you need to pay attention to. The one everyone will have heard about when you're talking about a plant-based diet is vitamin B12. It's not made by animals or plants. It's made by the microorganisms in the soil, so none of our diets are particularly high in vitamin B12. Many animals are fed the supplements of B12, and we then use the animal as the byproduct. So in a plant-based diet, you do need to have a reliable, regular source of vitamin B12. And the easiest and safest way to do that is to take a tablet either every day or a high-dose tablet once a week. Some people choose to get vitamin B12 from fortified foods like nutritional yeast or fortified milks. So that's the number one nutrient to be aware of. The other nutrient, which really isn't a nutrient as such, it's a hormone, is vitamin D, and that's relevant to all diet patterns. So during the winter months, the UK government recommend that all UK citizens supplement with vitamin D, and that's the same for a plant-based diet. And then you need to be aware of where you're getting your iodine from. So most of the UK are getting iodine from dairy products, because it's sort of added to cow's feed, and it's also leaches in from the sterilization of the equipment used in the production of dairy. So it's sort of a byproduct of dairy consumption. Iodine is obviously found in soils close to the ocean, so many of our plant foods are not rich in iodine, and certainly, you know, milk is not naturally high in iodine. It's because the cows are obtaining that mainly from their feed. So you just need to know where you're getting that from. So that could be from, you know, eating some sea vegetables. It could be from a supplement. It could be from iodized salts. You know, iodine deficiency is a global problem. It's one of the most common nutrient deficiencies globally and the commonest cause of brain damage in children. So iodized salt has been adopted by a lot of countries, although not not the UK, but you can find it here. And then you might want to consider emphasizing foods that are rich in essential omega-3 fatty acids. So that would be foods like flax seeds and walnuts and hemp seeds and soya products, so that you're getting the essential omega-3 fatty acids.
I love actually hearing about you talking about where we actually get some of those nutrients in meat-based products or animal-based products, because that is something that I think can be quite a barrier to people switching away from those foods, is that it seems like they're inherently including those nutrients, but actually it sounds like they're being added in, and that there's no reason why that shouldn't be the case or can't be the case with plant-based products. Or the fact that, you know, that we need to take supplements isn't necessarily a bad thing, because we're already supplementing those meat products. And I don't think I realize that. I don't think many people would realize that actually.
I agree. I didn't know until I decided to adopt a vegan diet and realised I didn't know how to plan a healthy vegan diet. And then I needed to learn myself. But, you know, all this information is now so hugely accessible. But, you know, if people ask me, oh, you know, what about your calcium and what about your B12? I ask them, well, where are you getting those nutrients? And it's amazing how little people know, you know, that calcium is a mineral in the soil and it's acquired from plant foods. And so, you know, we can get calcium from consuming plant foods. It's not a requirement to consume dairy because the cows get it from grass.
There's a real need for education around the topic with healthy eating in general, let alone just if you're moving to plant-based foods and diets.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you and I will recognise that much of our nutrition education comes from sort of mainstream media sources, which are so heavily influenced by the industry that are trying to sell you their products. So milk industry will want to tell you that calcium is, that dairy is required for calcium. It won't tell you where the cows are getting the calcium from, or that, you know, protein requirements mean that you have to eat meat. It does need a shift in education, and that is coming, isn't it? Because medical schools now have a nutrition curriculum, and hopefully there will be an emphasis on sustainable diets going forward as well.
You mentioned there about protein, which I think is something else that people are worried about getting enough of. Is there have you got any recommendations in terms of a plant-based diet and getting lots of protein? Is it a myth that we need meat for protein?
Absolutely. It really is a myth. You know, every single plant food has protein. I always tell people, well, think of the largest land animals on this planet. You know, our closest ancestors, the great apes, or even giraffes and hippos, they're all herbivores. They have plenty of protein. They're large and strong and don't require meat for protein. So every single plant food has protein. As long as you're eating enough calories and eating a variety of healthy foods, so all those four main food groups that I listed, so fruits, vegetables, whole grains, beans, and also a portion of nuts and seeds, you won't have any problem meeting your protein requirements. Most of us in the UK exceed our protein requirements, and most of the studies on vegans show that the vast majority of vegans also exceed protein requirements. So again, it's a myth. Protein as a nutrient seems to occupy many of our conversations around healthy diets.
So you're sort of mentioning there about the need to incorporate more whole foods, that it is safe and healthy to be vegan. But your organisation, Plant-Based Health Professionals, is promoting a fully plant-based diet. So what are your thoughts behind that, and why do you think it's better to be fully plant-based than just reducing down?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, we talk about 100% plant-based diets at Plant-Based Health Professionals, but we acknowledge and support people wherever they are on their journey and whatever they want that endpoint to be. And that's the sort of approach we would all take in clinical practice. But, you know, to fill that space of, you know, providing education about 100% plant-based diets, that's where I think we are unique as an organisation. And as I say, it really has those additional co-benefits for the animals and the environment. And the further you can go towards being 100% plant-based, the greater the benefits, without any detriment to your health. So we all can make that choice, and we're there to support people to get as close as possible to that point in a healthy way. There is quite a lot of data in the medical literature, which came as a huge surprise to me, about using 100% plant-based diets as a therapeutic intervention to treating our chronic conditions. So, people might be surprised to hear that the DASH diet, which is the dietary approaches to stop hypertension developed in the US, was a dietary pattern that was developed to be a therapeutic intervention for people with high blood pressure. And it was developed around the fact that it was well recognized that a vegetarian or vegan diet had benefits for preventing hypertension. You know, and as you've seen some of the data I've presented before, people on a plant-based diet have over sort of 60-70% reduction in their lifetime risk of developing high blood pressure. And so therapeutic diets have been developed around it, albeit not necessarily 100% for the DASH diet, but emphasizing those healthy plant foods that reduce hypertension. We've had studies and interventions for type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease showing great improvements in people with established conditions when they adopt a healthy 100% plant-based diet. And it's like with everything, the greater the change you make, the greater the potential health benefits there are up for grabs. Because as hopefully we've established already, none of the foods derived from animals are necessary for health promotion. And really, when you're choosing a piece of meat or eggs or dairy, you're sort of not choosing the healthier plant foods. So although we accept that plant-based health professionals, not the whole world is not going to go 100% plant-based, and we're here to provide evidence and education to show how you can do that and why you might want to.
Those figures aren't insignificant, are they? The 60-70% reduced likelihood. Is that right? Reduced likelihood of developing hypertension on a vegan and vegetarian diet?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's really significant. And so what is it about the meat side of things that predisposes you to these conditions?
Yeah, so there's obviously two sides to this story. You know, as I say, when we're talking about nutrition, you always have to think about what's being substituted. So if you're choosing to eat meat, you're not eating more of the healthy plant foods. So regarding, what is in meat that is less healthy compared to whole plant foods? Well, it's the whole package, isn't it? It's the fact that animal products are devoid of fiber, one of the key nutrients to promoting health. The animal products also come packaged with saturated fat, predominantly saturated fat, which we know is the key predictor of blood LDL cholesterol, which in turn is the driver of cardiovascular disease. It has the composition of meat protein is such that it contains more sulfur-containing amino acids, more branched-chain amino acids, which have been shown to have a detrimental health impact. And in contrast, if you think of the packaging of whole vegetables or beans or nuts and seeds, you know, it's packaged with fiber, unsaturated fatty acids, doesn't come with saturated fat. It's got protein and the right combination of amino acids. And, you know, it's devoid of these additional sort of chemicals that form when you're preparing, preserving and cooking meat. So meat cooked at high temperatures create carcinogens like heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. We know that processed red meat, for example, comes preserved with nitrates and nitrites, which then get converted into the gut to N-nitroso compounds that then, you know, create oxidative stress and inflammation and so forth, and lead to an increased risk of bowel cancer. So, you know, the mechanisms are quite clear. And actually, one of the most important mechanisms that everyone talks about is the health of the gut microbiome. 70% of our immune system is in our gut. And every chronic disease you can think of has been associated with dysfunction or dysbiosis of the microbiome. And as I've already referred to, the health of our gut is intimately related to the food we eat. And the key nutrients are fiber, polyphenols, resistant starches, and, you know, maybe a portion of fermented food, and avoiding all the types of foods that lead to bacteria, unhealthy bacteria thriving, and that's generally those fiber devoid animal foods that are really not doing our gut microbiome any good.
And you mentioned there about the carcinogenic effect of meat. And I remember when I heard you talk at the EcoMedics conference earlier this year, you mentioned about red meat being a class one carcinogen, and that in your words, it's criminal that we serve this in our hospitals where we're supposed to be promoting health. Do you mind just delving into that a bit more?
Yeah, so back in 2015, the WHO, having accumulated evidence from more than 800 studies, put out a statement saying that processed red meat, so things like bacon and sausages and deli meats, are a group one carcinogen, so they directly cause cancer. And that was mainly related to colorectal cancer, where the risks are higher, but actually processed red meat increases the risk of other common cancers like breast cancer, prostate cancer, and some of the rarer cancers like pancreatic cancer. And, you know, if you think about the sort of numbers of colorectal cancer that are due to the consumption of processed red meat in the UK, the Cancer Research UK states that around 13% of cancers, colorectal cancers, are due to the consumption of processed red meat, which is around 5,500 cases a
wow.
year. Yeah, and then if you add on the consumption of red meat, so red meat is a probable carcinogen, group 2A, so not definitive, but probably increases the risk of colorectal cancer plus other cancers. And then when you add that to the consumption of processed red meat, 20% of cancers of the colorectum could be prevented if we did not eat these foods. And that amounts to over 8,000 cases of colorectal cancer. And it's not just that in isolation, is it? We know that red and processed red meat increase the risk of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, carrying too much weight, dementia, I could go on, inflammatory bowel disease. So, you know, the numbers are just become ridiculously high. You know, if you think that those cases could be prevented, you know, with removing a certain food from your diet, then that's potentially huge. And I think in institutions like hospitals, like schools, we should be promoting foods that are really associated with the best health, using this as teachable moments. You know, nobody wants to wake up after their colorectal surgery and be offered sausage and mash, which apparently is the most common and favorite food of patients at King's College Hospital. People might like it, but I think it's a moment to just reconsider, you know, better choices when you're recovering from a life-threatening illness. Now, I mean, obviously, we need to caveat this and say that clearly not all conditions, not all cancers are preventable, and this is just one piece of a big puzzle. But, you know, it's not dissimilar to the story with smoking. You know, it was back in the 1960s when the Surgeon General from the US revealed to the world that smoking causes cancer of the lung, and it took the UK hospitals approximately 50 years for smoking to be banned on the grounds of the hospital. So, but yeah, I think, you know, in a hospital environment, in a canteen, what we feed our staff and patients has to be what we consider the healthiest possible choices, and we should be supporting our patients to adopt healthier diets, because we know that the diet of the UK, the typical UK citizen, is far removed from what we would deem as healthy, and that one in four deaths now in the UK are caused by an unhealthy diet, whether it be cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, or cancer. You know, we have a long way to go, but we need to be pushing for these changes so that we can not only improve personal health, but obviously what's pertinent to today's conversation is that what's less good for our personal health is also terrible for the environment.
Now, when we're talking about plant-based and vegan diets, is it a blanket approach, or are there caveats in avoiding processed vegan foods too? Because, of course, one thing that we're seeing in response to an increasing number of vegans is an abundance of processed meat alternatives on supermarket shelves. Are there red flags around these? Because I know you've been talking about whole foods. Should people, if they're moving towards vegan diets, be avoiding these, or, you know, thinking about this?
Yeah, you know, and I think, you know, we need to use common sense and understand the drivers of why these processed vegan foods are suddenly on our shelves. There's a demand, there's more people wanting to eat less meat and animal foods, which is great because we're all concerned about climate health and the animals, animal welfare. So it's great that there's a demand and the food industry is reacting to that demand. But we do have to understand that they're only interested in the bottom line, which is their profit, and they really don't care about the healthiness of the foods that are being created. And again, we've known for decades that ultra processed foods and processed foods, the more you include in your diet, the less well you're going to be in terms of your health outcomes. So as I often say, there's more than one way to eat badly. So and we've found all the different ways. And one of the major problems in the UK is that more than 50% of what we put in our shopping baskets is classified as ultra processed foods. And that's not going to matter if that ultra processed food is made from plants or animal foods. It's still going to contribute to ill health and not provide the extent of nutrients that we require to thrive. So, yes, I think that we should be cautious, and you know, a processed meat product and vegan product may be equally bad. We haven't had the long-term studies on this, but we can use common sense because they all have additives, preservatives, and they're far removed from the whole plant food. But there's a spectrum, isn't there? So, you know, we've always had sort of fake meats in inverted commas. You know, many cultures, you know, eat a lot of tofu and tempeh and seitan, and they're probably, they are absolutely fine to include in the diet. But when we're thinking about impossible foods and beyond meat and those sort of products, they're likely to be less healthy. However, we have actually had a head-to-head short-term study comparing on organic beef to people consuming beyond meat products. I think it was about a 16-week study, and then participants crossed over. And actually, there were better health outcomes in the beyond meat. But I'm not saying that we should be.
Interesting.
No, because it does, of course, have fibre, less saturated fat. I think the main problem with a lot of these products is that they're quite high in salt. But, you know, I don't think we should talk about avoiding and not doing this and not doing that. It's about making sure your diet is full of healthy plant foods. And now and again, if we go out to a restaurant, we go to a social or family gathering, and you know, we're going to choose a plant version of a sausage or a burger because we don't want our diet choices to be adversely impacting the environment, then that's fine. You know, we're never going to be 100% whole food plant-based, probably, and very few people are, and we have to live adequately in the society we're in and be able to do all the things we want to do. So there's a place for the products, but I don't think we should be thinking about replacing meat with these newer products. We don't need to. We've always had beans and nuts and seeds to get our protein from, and we've got an abundance of fruits and vegetables and whole grains that we should be eating instead.
EcoMedics is a non-profit organisation run by volunteer healthcare professionals alongside their clinical roles treating patients. In each episode, we include a short message from our generous sponsors, which allows us to keep doing what we do while also promoting other change-making organisations. If you'd be interested in sponsoring an episode, please get in touch by emailing hello@ecomedics.co.uk.
So we've already sort of mentioned how disease prevention in plant-based diets or ideally moving towards more whole food plant-based diets can be really positive for the environment because it reduces the health burden and ultimately the environmental impacts of the healthcare system. But of course, there are significant direct benefits to the planet of eating plant-based and reducing meat consumption. I know you have a wealth of knowledge around this. So I'd love to discuss that.
Yeah, for sure. I think, again, it's not talked about enough. You know, a diet choice really is the single most impactful action we can take as individuals to do our bit to mitigate against the impacts on the climate. It's something we do 3 times a day, and we can make that choice that will be kinder to the environment and better for our health. So just with some general facts and figures, around 30 to 35% of greenhouse gas emissions are from the food system as a whole. And more than 50%, so 50 to 60% of that, those greenhouse gas emissions are due to raising animals for food. So if we cut out the animals, we would immediately reduce greenhouse gas emissions by about 50%. And that's been what's been borne out in all the modelling studies. And we think about carbon, but of course, animals contribute nitrous oxide and methane, which are two gases that have greater warming potential than carbon. And nitrous oxide lasts in the atmosphere for over 100 years. But it's not just about greenhouse gas emissions. If it was, that would be relatively straightforward. The trouble is that the way we are raising animals for food is also leading to biodiversity loss. You know, we're already in the sixth mass extinction event. We've destroyed so much of wildlife and animal habitats. We've polluted the land and water from the residue and the runoff from animal agriculture. The oceans are polluted. We've completely overfished our oceans that are at capacity, if not over capacity, when it comes to fish. And, you know, it's the biggest cause of land use change. You know, we need land to be storing and capturing carbon, yet we are using more and more land to convert to farmland to either graze animals or use that land to grow crops to feed animals. And, you know, one really devastating example is the deforestation of the Amazon forest. You know, the Amazon forest has become an emitter of carbon. You know, it's the lungs of the whole planet, and yet we've now made it into a forest that actually emits carbon, which is shocking to learn about. And the biggest driver of deforestation of the Amazon forest is clearing of the land to graze animals or to grow crops such as soya to feed animals. So animal agriculture is the cause of more than 90% of Amazon deforestation.
So just to clarify there, so you're talking about cutting down trees, which we need to absorb that CO2 that we're constantly pumping out in the current lifestyle that we're living. So by cutting those down, we're essentially removing a significant way of counteracting those activities. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And the Amazon is just one example. But if you just think that 83% of farmland globally and 70% in the UK is dedicated to raising animals for food, whether it be grazing animals or growing their feed. So the vast majority of farmland is dedicated to raising animals. And I hope I've persuaded the listeners that it's a food that we really do not need. So we could be liberating that land back to its natural habitats, rewilding, reforesting, using that land to capture carbon rather than being emitter of carbon, as you say, whilst at the same time reducing vastly the emissions of nitrous oxide and methane.
If we just use that land, if we just use the land to grow plants that we directly ate, is that significantly less than how much we're needing to feed these farm animals?
Yeah, the studies have been done. If we only ate a vegan or plant-based diet, we would liberate 75% of farmland globally.
Wow.
While still being able to feed, you know, the projected 10 billion people by 2030. So there's absolutely no doubt. We currently produce enough food to feed two planets. And the sad situation is that more than a billion people, or around a billion people, remain hungry and food insecure. But the inefficiency of the system is so huge. And one of the key inefficiencies, is that we're growing all these crops to feed animals. And that conversion of crop to, you know, animal calories or protein is hugely inefficient. You know, the animal agriculture only produce about 18% of calories consumed globally and 37% of protein.
Wow. And I remember something else that you said before is if everyone on the planet ate like we do here in the UK, we would need seven planets to feed the world, which is shocking. It just shows sort of, obviously that we know that there's an unequal distribution of the people that are consuming and emitting compared to those who are going to be suffering the effects of climate change. So that just puts into perspective how poor the system is, particularly here in the UK.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it also highlights that point about justice, climate justice. You know, our actions in high income countries are really severely adversely affecting the health and quality of life of people distant to us. But it's our actions. And that's why I talk about 100% plant-based diet, because in the UK, we really could do it. We could make that big, big impact by, completely changing the way we eat. We have the resource, the ability, the infrastructure to completely change things, whereas that might be less true of smaller communities that might be reliant on, you know, aquaculture or very reliant on their use of animals for various foods. And that's not to say we can't adapt globally, but the high income countries have the ability to adapt faster, whereas actually the trends are showing that we are becoming more and more destructive, and that destruction is really having its impact distance to us in countries that are not able to cope with the impacts of climate change.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because some of these low-income settings as well, even though their diets might consist of meat as well, it doesn't tend to be as featured as it is in our, what we say, perhaps Western diets, where we could be eating meat 3 times a day, whereas that's not necessarily what's happening in low-income settings. So is this sort of move towards development and becoming richer, is that involving a transition towards more meat and dairy consumption?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think our move from sort of more rural settings to urban settings, whether that be for, you know, job opportunities or because, you know, farming is very difficult to now make money from and people are not able to sort of feed themselves from the land, as it were. It's the sort of corporate hold of our food system. But yes, you know, as we get wealthier, as we live more sort of urban lives, the transition has been to more meat heavy diets, and there's so many factors that have influenced us. But yes, I think as we accumulate wealth, you know, we see meat as being desirable and macho and associated with wealth and power and what have you, as I say, mainly because of the way it's been sold to us. And if you think back to traditional cultural diets like mine from South Asia, it's very much plant-based. And, you know, most people in India still currently eat a, you know, mostly plant-based diet. I think the problem with diets in lower income countries is that it's become very monotonous. I think I've stated this statistic before, that 60% of calories globally come from 4 plant foods. So we're mainly eating soya, maize, wheat, and I think potatoes. So we've got diets that are so non-diverse, and we've moved away from the farmland. We've become much more industrialized in our food production, and we're just not getting enough of the nutritious whole plant foods. And as you say, as we become wealthier, we're adding in the meat rather than adding in an abundance of healthy plant foods. But just going back to my cultural diet, it's so easy to be 100% plant-based.
And also, I suppose that move away from farming cultures creates a disconnect between, you know, the ethical side of things as well, in not having to sort of see the actual process of killing animals to eat and appreciating the animal itself before you then use it for food, that there is that disconnect. And I suppose we're moving towards it being a luxury to have meat and it just being so accessible without having to think about the ethical side of things as well.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason it is so accessible to eat meat in the UK is because of the way we've industrialised the production in these factory farms that the vast majority of us do not have to see. In fact, we're not able to see. It's not, you're not allowed to go into a factory farm, but yet we outsource this work of, you know, slaughterhouse working to the marginalised communities that have no other choice but to work in this industry that then ends up harming them physically and mentally.
Also, I suppose what feeds into that as well is the government subsidisation of the farming industry as well. So we don't realise that maybe the value of meat, because it's so heavily subsidised, so it seems really cheap. And I think that's one part of it as well. Some people see vegan and plant-based diets as perhaps a bit inaccessible financially, because when you go for lunch and you want to pick up a meal deal or something, the ham sandwiches, the bacon rolls, the sausage rolls, they're so cheap sometimes compared to these whole foods. And it looks as though it's less valuable or, you know, cheaper, but it's not actually. It's because of this subsidisation, which many people aren't aware of.
Yeah, agree. You know, the dairy and meat industry are heavily subsidised. Otherwise, the industry would be financially bankrupt. And if you started taking into account the environmental impact of the industry, it would be totally unaffordable for any of us to consume meat.
Something else to consider, I think, as well, in terms of health benefits and I suppose environmental benefits of when we're thinking about plant versus meat diets is antibiotic resistance. Would you mind talking to us a bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's such an important topic and we don't talk about it enough in the health space. So as you will know, the trends in antibiotic resistant infections are only rising. We've had a publication just earlier this year in The Lancet looking at the number of deaths caused by antibiotic resistant infections in 2019 globally. And basically the data showed that death from antibiotic resistant infections is the 12th leading cause of death globally. It kills more people than HIV infection and malaria. And it in 2019, 1.3 million people globally died of antibiotic resistance directly due to antibiotic resistant infections. That's huge, and those trends are only increasing. And if you extrapolate that out to, you know, the year 2050, we're going to be losing millions, if not billions, of people to these infections where we no longer have antibiotics that are sensitive to the infections they have. And, you know, I think we need to make the connection. We need to be clear that the vast majority of antibiotics produced and used on this planet, probably around 70% globally, are used to raise animals for food. It's a much smaller amount used for human health. And this requirement for antibiotics in animal agriculture really comes from the fact that, you know, we are squeezing in more and more animals to smaller spaces in what we term as factory farms here in the UK. They're squalid, awful conditions where without antibiotics, animals wouldn't be able to be raised to slaughter weight and farmers would be losing their animals. And their feces are then full of antibiotic residue and also antibiotic resistant strains of bacteria that are polluting our land and water and exposing us as humans to those antibiotic resistance genes, the antibiotic resistant infections themselves, and also to low levels of antibiotics in our water.
That's so, I think it's so important, and a lot of people don't necessarily know that about the antibiotics being used, because there is so much, I think, education being pushed now around antibiotic resistance and the potential detrimental effects it's going to be having in the next few years, and so much of that comes from animals, which is really interesting. Now, food is a really tricky one. Something I wanted to mention to you, because you said there that it's the single most impactful thing an individual can do for our planet. Yet, I think it's one of the most challenging ones for people to change. In my experience, people are willing to switch, you know, to plastic-free packaging, reduce car use, turn their lights off, use less water, all of these things. But when it comes to changing their diets, reducing meat and dairy, it's a whole different ball game. And you know, for many communities, food is the centre of culture and celebration and joy, and people have a real emotional connection with it. You mentioned there about coming from a South Indian family. My family are from North India, and everything is centred around food and within that meat. So it's a huge challenge to change attitudes around this. And I wonder if you had any advice in this regard.
Yeah, now this is a really tricky question, Aisling. I mean, I think this is the key, isn't it? It's the behaviour change aspect. You know, it's not enough just having the knowledge. It's being able to support people to make those healthy, sustainable changes. I mean, I think you've said everything that there is to say. It's because our food choices are emotional and they're tied up into our identity, our social and cultural backgrounds, and people become defensive. Nobody wants to be told that, you know, their favourite meals that their parents cooked for them are really actually not very healthy for them and are contributing to, you know, the climate crisis. So I think we can only show by example and normalise everything and do what you're doing, which is just showing how, you know, acceptable, nutritious and desirable having a plant-based diet is. And what you guys did at the conference, just displaying how abundant and delicious the food is, and, you know, making it a norm, you know, in this sort of in the research that has been done when it comes to changing social norms, you just need sort of around 3.5% of the population to be doing something to then have a real momentum of change. So I think we just need to build that momentum and normalise these choices whilst providing that education and resource so people can adopt a healthy plant-based diet. But, you know, it's a tough fight because we're fighting against the food industry who have this tight hold over, you know, government and policy. And so, you know, that's why what we're doing, I think, is really valuable. It's really at the grassroots level, showing people, teaching people how straightforward and simple it is. And, you know, I don't know what more we can do. I mean, at a higher strategy level, we need to be lobbying our politicians, our those in power that do have the ability to influence on a larger scale. And, you know, as health professionals, we really do have a valuable voice because we are respected. And I think that comes that again comes back to the fact that as health professionals, we have a duty to support our patients to make these healthy choices for themselves and, you know, our future generations.
And how else, as health professionals, can we lead the way in this shift towards healthier plant-based whole food diets?
So I think there's a number of ways, you know, that we can all impact. First thing is about, you know, leading by example, being the change and, you know, showing people that it's straightforward and easy. So make the change yourself. I think in primary practice, you guys are really fortunate that you get to know your patients, you get to know their social circumstances, you've got the ability to sort of, you know, prescribe, you know, the social prescribing that can be around kitchens and foods. And so it's about teaming up with community organisations that can support your patients also to make those changes and continually reinforcing these behaviour changes and supporting them to do so. In my hospital setting, I can speak more on a personal level. We've really tried to work with the sustainability teams. We've been trying to promote healthy plant-based diets in the workplace, first starting with staff. So we've been running campaigns like Veganuary and just completed No Meat May and getting staff to sign up, having events and talks and grand rounds about it, showing and teaching people how straightforward it is, getting the canteen to have more plant-based meals. We had meat-free Mondays on Earth Day. We had a fully plant-based day. And continually doing that, you know, our health and wellbeing hub, we asked them to only be providing soya milk and vegan snacks. So there's lots of small things we can do. And then we're working with the wider dietetic team and the caterers to be really shifting the patient menus to a more plant-based menu, really not having special menus. I think we need to get rid of special menus, and every menu needs to have lots of plant-based options, because at the end of the day, they are appropriate meals for everybody, for dietary restrictions, for religious reasons, for allergies. You know, a plant-based diet really can be a universal approach to all of these things. And then, you know, the special bits can be, you know, if you have to have, you know, a certain amount of animal foods or whatever. So, you know, it's just changing that mindset and trying to get the menus to focus on more sustainability. And ultimately, I'd like to see red meat off our menus, but we've got a little way to go. But I think just need to keep pushing in that area of influence that you have. And our workplace is a great place to start.
And if people wanted to get involved with plant-based health professionals and learn a bit more about this, because obviously within the scope of this podcast, there's so much we still haven't managed to cover. But I know you deliver a programme in order to accredit people with this education. How could they get involved?
Yeah, so in terms of my organisation, Plant Based Health Professionals, you can just check us out on the website, plantbasedhealthprofessionals.com. You can just use all of our resources. So we have loads of free downloadable fact sheets that you can use for yourself or with your patients. We've got loads of up-to-date articles. We have fortnightly webinars. We also have a 21-day plant-based health challenge. So you sign up, you get 21 days of emails, resources, videos, recipes to get your journey started.
Oh, that sounds great.
Just reuse all the resources. And then if you do want to support us, you know, we're a community interest company. It's great to build a network of individuals and get a bit of income. You are very welcome to join as a member, which is open to everybody, not just health professionals. And then I think what you're referring to is I also work at Winchester University, where I provide an online facilitated course on plant-based nutrition and clinical practice that has been CPD accredited for 30 hours of CPD by the British Society of Lifestyle Medicine. It's also part of the Greener Impact Toolkit for GP practices. So it's part of the Silver Awards. So you can, in all good faith, use that as your CPD for the year or whatever you need. And it's an 8-week online self-paced course with all the information you need, with all the resources that will make you feel comfortable for making this shift to a plant-based diet for yourself and supporting your patients.
And Shireen, I know you've got a new book out.
Yes, my sister and I co-authored a book called Eating Plant-Based, Scientific Answers to Your Nutrition Questions, which came out in January of this year. And it really covers every single question you might want to know the answer to around eating a plant-based diet, predominantly for health, but we do also cover questions and answers around the impact of our food choices and the climate. So everything we've talked about today, you can find out in much more detail with our book, which is available at all booksellers, and you can find on my website, plantbasedhealthprofessionals.com.
Amazing. Thank you, Shireen. I've got some quick fire questions just to round off. If you could give one key piece of advice to people about sustainable living, what would it be?
Well, this won't be any surprise to you. I would just say, you know, eat more plant foods. We're just not eating enough. And so just think about adding additional and new plant-based foods to your diet every day, every week.
What do you wish you knew sooner?
That I didn't need to be eating animals to be healthy.
What will you tell future generations about your role in the climate crisis?
Well, I hope I can relay a positive impact on just changing minds and education for health professionals around plant-based diets and as we've said, normalising this as the way to sustain ourselves and thrive on this planet.
Describe to us your vision of a greener world.
It's a difficult one. I think that I would like to see us living a kinder, more compassionate life on this planet and to extend our circle of compassion to nature, to non-human animals, and of course, our fellow humans. And a sort of a sustainable, greener future would be where everyone, regardless of wealth and status, had equal access to make healthy lifestyle choices to better themselves and their families.
And can the health sector become truly sustainable?
I think it can, but I think you referred to how this needs to happen. It needs to happen by having a greater emphasis on health promotion and disease prevention. We need to require less of the healthcare, whereas at the moment we're requiring more and more healthcare resource. We need to prevent those illnesses that are preventable and focus on keeping people in good health in the broader sense.
Shireen, thank you so, so much. I think the message around food is so important when talking about environmental sustainability, particularly as health professionals. And I think you've done an incredible job of illustrating the need to be bringing this to the forefront of our discussions.
Thanks very much, Aisling.
EcoMedics is a non-profit organisation challenging health professionals and the healthcare industry to recognise the urgency of the climate crisis and to implement change to become sustainable. To stay up to date with our projects and events, and for climate news and sustainability tips, make sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @eco_medics and sign up to our newsletter using the link below or by heading to newsletter.ecomedics.co.uk. Lastly, don't forget to check out our website,
www.ecomedics.co.uk, where you can calculate your carbon footprint, carbon offset your unavoidable emissions, access step-by-step sustainability guides, and buy from our non-profit shop with carefully selected sustainable partners. Ecomedics is run by a team of volunteers, and all proceeds go into the running costs of the organisation. If you want to show your support, you can also donate by heading to buymeacoffee.com/ecomedics. Thank you so much again for tuning in, and don't forget to share this episode with friends and family and on social media. We look forward to seeing you again next week for another episode. Bye for now.